This is News in Notes. I'm Ed Gordon. On today's roundtable, Maryland's lieutenant governor calls his black critics racist. Also, is Libby worse than Lewinsky? We'll talk about that today on our roundtable with New York editorial writer for the New York Post, Robert George. Joining us from our Chicago bureau is Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times. She's a columnist there. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. He joins us today from Maryland. All right, folks, one of the things that we want to talk about today is what we talked about, I guess, last week, and that's Maryland Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele. And he has been berated by a number of African Americans. We talked about a doctored picture of him in blackface on a website. And he has currently suggested in a recent interview that he thinks that it diminishes leadership and, most importantly, embarrasses the state and other elected officials. And he has suggested that when his character comes under attack and the like, that it really does not bode well, that all of this is simply because he's a Republican, and anyone who does that of in terms of the attack and who is black, he sees as racist, just as a white might call him the N-word. George Curry, is this a little bit of a stretch, or do you buy it?
I wouldn't call it racist, but I would say this. As a person who has ridiculed Clarence Thomas and being proud of it, I think you need to make the distinction between people who are Republican and have the interests of the African-American community at heart. I mean, you can be a Republican and still be black. Let's go there first. I mean, there, you look back, when you go back to William Coleman, or you go back to the old line Republicans, they were Republicans, but they never gave up civil rights. Now, the difference is, well, Clarence Thomas is totally different. Steele, for example, supports affirmative action. He's not a Clarence Thomas. And so I wouldn't give him the same treatment I would give a Clarence Thomas. But on the other hand, I got to say, when you're in the public eye, you're a public official, you just have to take it and be ready for any kind of ridicule, especially from editorial cartoonists or anybody else. That's part of the landscape. But I would make a real distinction.
His suggestion is it's beyond just the lampooning, the political lampooning, that others are taking pot shots at him, he thinks, unfairly as well.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm going to talk about the black part, because I think it's so important, because there are people in the Republican Party, black, who really do care about the community. And I think that you do have a different standard. But in terms of lampoon, I mean, some of the things unfair, like, you know, pulling his credit report and those kinds of things. I mean, it's gone over the line. It really has.
Exactly. And, I mean, I think also it has to be kept in context. This interview that he had followed up a previous story where a number of Maryland black Democrats seemed to be saying that some of the racial language and some of the stunts, such as throwing Oreo cookies at him during a campaign and so forth, seemed to be legitimate. In fact, I think one woman was quoted as saying, you know, party trumps race, especially at the national level. So I think in the specifics that Steele was talking about, I think he had an absolutely legitimate point, because, again, this was also in the context of, it seemed like some of these local politicians in Maryland, some of the local black politicians, were basically, in a sense, saying that some of that, the Sambo and minstrel imagery that had appeared on this website was, you know, seemed to be fair. Now, in fairness, Kwesi Amfume, who could very well end up facing Michael Steele in a general election, he said that, you know, that kind of stuff has absolutely no place in the politics, and good for him for standing up and saying that.
Absolutely. And we should note, in the general election for the Senate seat in Maryland.
In the Senate seat, that's right.
Absolutely, it has no place. If these were white politicians who were throwing these kinds of racial epithets and images at Mr. Steele, they'd be excoriated. There should be no difference here. This is about playing the race card. We can't tolerate a double standard. We can't say that we won't accept that kind of treatment from white politicians or from anybody white, and then turn around and say it's okay when it's just among us. I mean, the other thing you got to think about is whether or not.
Yet, let's be honest. That happens quite a bit with African Americans who run against African Americans. I mean, we talk about the race card.
We talk about the race card
when whites play it, yet, you know, there is this kind of wink and a nod in politics among blacks to find out who's, quote, blacker.
In fact, just a few years ago in the race between Mayor Sharp James and Cory Booker in Newark, you had a case where James, the incumbent, successfully painted Booker as being sort of the light-skinned tool of these white Republican interests, and he won re-election by doing that.
I think we need to not forget
George. We interrupted her. Go ahead, Laura, and then George, pick up.
And Cory Booker is going to come back, but you know, you also have to wonder whether those kinds of attacks are really going to weaken him or strengthen him among his base. If his base is indeed mainly white Republicans, there might be a sympathy factor there. I think that you can always beat a candidate on the issues, and you don't need to bring the race card up. Here in Chicago, you recall last year, we had a race between Alan Keyes and Barack Obama for the U.S. Senate. Alan Keyes, very conservative base. All of his support was white. His positions and his agenda had little interest to the black voter. Barack Obama didn't have to go racial on him. The voters simply just ignored him.
That was a special case.
Absolutely, but I still think that you can always beat somebody on the issues, and when you have to resort to name-calling of any kind, you undercut yourself.
George, you wanted to say?
Yeah, I don't think we get too carried away here, that part of this is part and parcel of politics. I mean, I don't see it that much different from what happened in Virginia being nasty, or in New Jersey more so, when they pull out a guy's ex-wife and use that as a commercial. I mean, part of it is rough politics. But the other part is there's a point where you go over the line. For example, when he would speak at Morgan State and throwing Oreo cookies at him, I thought was unfair. And I think I think he can stand on his own issues. And again, I make the distinction between Steele and a Clarence Thomas.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's turn our attention to the latest numbers from the Pew Research Center, and that's for the people and the press. And they take a look, for those who aren't familiar, and take snapshots in time of the political fever of the United States. Most recently, a poll they took really speaks to where the American public is with much of what is surrounding George Bush's White House. 79% of those who were polled said that the recent indictment of Louis Libby is a matter of at least some importance to the nation. That is, in contrast, they released this, a greater percentage of people who believe that when Clinton lied under oath about the sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky, where the number rose only to 65%. With that juxtaposition, Laura, as a guide, does this in fact speak to how important people are seeing this indictment of a man who sits so close to the vice president?
You're talking about the difference between sex in the White House and political, potentially criminal activity in the White House, and I do indeed think that people are making that distinction. I'm frankly a little surprised that there's that high level of awareness, because the folks out in Washington will tell you this is just a Washington story on both sides of the fence. They'll tell you this is just, you know, typical insider politics, and this is a minor thing. It's about lying, but that's exactly what the Clinton issue was. It was also about lying. I think the key reason why this issue is going to stay alive is that because Mr. Libby has decided to fight this indictment, and he's going to fight it tooth and nail to keep himself out of jail. In the process, there's going to be a need for testimony from high-level officials in the White House, maybe even Dick Cheney. This story is going to roll out and continue to roll out into the midterm elections, and I think public interest is going to grow with it.
Here are the two numbers that interested. Go ahead, George.
The thing that was really interesting to me was the mountain criticism. For example, you see that an increasing number of Americans found that the U.S. and British leaders were lying when they claimed that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. I mean, you see that. You see that 42% think Libby was guilty. They've already reached a verdict on it before the trial. I'm looking at the trend there. And when you keep looking at these Pew studies, it's getting worse. Most of the Americans feel they have been duped.
George, you beat me to my question. Robert, pick up on this, and then you guys can follow up. And George, that was going to be my next question. The most interesting numbers to me are what you just said. It shows a plurality of Americans, 42% believe that Libby is in fact guilty of the charges that are brought against him, and 43% believe that U.S. and British leaders lied when claiming Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction. Yet it seems as though, and I'm reading into this, these numbers admittedly so, but I said this the other day, it seems to me that the American people have just almost resigned themselves to lies from politicians.
Yeah, you've been duped, you've been hoodwinked, bamboozled. I think that's partly the case. What I think is very interesting here, though, is that until just before Special Counsel Patrick Fitzgerald, came out with his indictment of Libby. Monica Lewinsky thing, because it's sex, obviously everybody was covering it at the time. This was something that had not been really, 24/7 on all of the cable stations. And I think it's very interesting that it so quickly people have become aware of what's going on, which is something I tell my conservative and Republican friends is, it is a major mistake for them to think that it's just going on in Washington and so forth. People are paying attention to it, and it speaks to the credibility, certainly, of Dick Cheney. It speaks to the credibility of President Bush. And I think, I say this as a Republican, I think he has to, in a sense, be more straightforward in terms of what he feels is going to be appropriate behavior. It's not just a matter of they're now sending White House aides to, ethics classes and all this other kind of stuff. If he really wants to be successful in terms of his Iraq and other foreign policy, he has to once again try and restore the credibility of his administration, or otherwise he's going to be floundering for the next 3 years.
Here's some interesting numbers out of this, though, and Laura, follow up on this. The idea that almost 2-1, those surveyed here suggest that the nomination of Judge Samuel Alito is favorable to this administration.
Well, I think the administration has to first pull itself out of a trig bag that it put itself in terms of its own responses in the Libby scandal. They've been saying all along that there was no one in the White House who was feeding information to reporters about Valerie Plame, and now clearly that is not the case. They've repeatedly said that over and over again, and the campaign commercials of whoever the Democratic candidates are going to be replete with video of White House spokespeople saying, "We didn't know, we didn't do this, we didn't do that, we didn't say this, we didn't say that." So he's not only is the president going to, as Robert says, have to, sort of fess up and be more forthright, but he's going to have to try to undo a lot of damage that he's already done himself.
The Alito point,
let me
go back to your Alito question. It does not rank high on the public's attitudes in terms of high issues. I mean, in fact, if you look at the report, only 5% thought it was an important issue. They were much more concerned about the war, the death, the hurricane aftermath, and Libya, all way ahead of Alito. So I just don't think they're really on the radar screen.
But it's also in the context of the debacle of Harriet Myers, and I think the few people who are familiar with Alito at least recognize, even though they may not know all about his philosophy, they at least recognize him as somebody who actually is a man of quality and at least reaches the bar of being acceptable in terms of qualifications.
Well, does that still speak to how the layperson looks at an appointment for the Supreme Court? George, you suggest that it isn't high on their radar screen, but people have to at some point realize how important these nominations are, whether you like the nominee or not.
I think they understand that it's important, but let's put this in perspective. Number one is Iraq War. That's the number one thing on their issues. I mean, on their mind. Katrina, that was second. And then the Libya stuff. So when you think about the war in Katrina, I understand why the numbers are higher.
Yeah, but the irony of that is, though, that Katrina is in the big picture, it's a temporary situation, and even in Iraq may be going for a couple more years. But Alito, you're talking about a Supreme Court nominee who could be on the court and influencing policy for the next 30 years. So it's interesting how people recognize what's important and what's not.
And to a great degree, that's the question, Laura, in the sense that if we take those numbers, 11% felt that, in fact, the Libby case was more important in juxtaposing it to the 5% who suggested the appointment of the Supreme Court nominee was important.
Well, I think, again, it's been said, quality, I think, trumps the controversy that gets pushed on in terms of specific issues that that Supreme Court candidates have been identified with. I think people are looking for quality, as you saw in a John Roberts, and I think as you've seen in Alito. I would also add to George's list, though, the economy is, and I think that Katrina is related, directly related to that, the economy, the rise of gas prices, concerns and fears about housing prices. I think that those are the things, that those are the pocketbook issues that people are really worried about now. And I think there's a lot of concern that the Bush administration is not addressing those pockets.
And if there is even maybe a glimmer of hope that the Republicans might be looking at in some of these numbers, the only thing they may put their finger on is the fact that gas prices have dropped quite a lot in the last month, and that may influence on how people feel about the economy.
But that was after they reported those profits, Robert. They had to do something.
Well, you know,
let me ask you all,
take the money and
literally
run,
with literally about a minute and a half to go, as relates to what we saw yesterday. I asked this of our two political experts. Do we see? Can we read anything out of what we saw yesterday in terms of any victories across the country, and whether or not we're going to see the black base energized when midterm elections come up? Real quick for me,
Just very, very quickly, here in New York, and in fact, the big states, the party in power kept power. I think Michael Bloomberg was somebody who managed to come across as a moderate Republican, made himself acceptable to the black community, and I think that's why he basically was able to split the Democratic base.
Mm-hmm. I don't see anything revolutionary, but you see pockets, particularly in Northern Virginia, that were Republican, did turn, and that became a referendum on George Bush. Laura?
I see two ongoing trends that don't have anything to do with the black vote, and that is the influence of money in politics. You know, $73 million in the New Jersey race was spent. Bloomberg alone spent $66 million.
So I think it's still growing.
Pardon?
And still counting, actually.
Yeah, it's still absolutely still counting. And that does have a connection to black voters in the sense that we don't have access to those kinds of dollars, and that puts us at an extreme disadvantage.
Mayor Bloomberg even put a lot of money in a lot of black media and radio here, too. He was going after every single vote he could get. And, you know, more power to him if he's got the money for it.
And he's got the money.
All right, I just let that go silent for a reason, but all right. George, Laura, and Robert, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Ed.